Every so often we get a live one. We missed that guy by a half hour outside Beirut last March. 30 goddamn minutes, Cantor said. You get used to it. 30 minutes, Jack thought. If I'd left my office 30 minutes earlier, I'd be dead. How am I supposed to get used to that?
What would you have done to him?
We wouldn't have read him his constitutional rights, Cantor replied.
So, any connections that you've been able to find?
Ryan shook his head. This ULA outfit is so goddamn small. I have 16 suspected contacts between the IRA and other groups. Some of them could be our boys, but how can you tell? The reports don't have pictures. The written descriptions could be anybody. Even when we have a reported IRA contact with a bunch they're not supposed to be talking to, one that might actually be the ULA, then A, our underlying information could easily be wrong, and B, it could be the first time they talked with the IRA.
Marty, how in the hell is somebody supposed to make any sense out of this garbage?
Well, the next time you hear somebody ask what the CIA is doing about terrorism, you won't be able to tell him. Cantor actually smiled at that. These people we're looking for aren't dumb. They know what'll happen if they get caught. Even if we don't do it ourselves, which we might not want to do, we can always tip the Israelis. Terrorists are tough, nasty bastards, but they can't stand up to real troops, and they know it. That's the frustrating part. My brother-in-law is an army major, part of the Delta Force down at Fort Bragg. I've seen them operate. They could take out this camp you looked at in under 2 minutes, kill everybody there, and be gone before the echo fades. They're deadly and efficient, but without the right information, they don't know where to be deadly and efficient at. Same with police work. Do you think the mafia could survive if the cops knew exactly where and when they did their thing? How many bank robberies would be successful if the SWAT team was waiting inside the doors? But you gotta know where the crooks are. It's all about intelligence. And intelligence comes down to a bunch of faceless bureaucrats sifting through all this crap. The people who gather the intel give it to us, and we process it and give it to the operations teams. The battle is fought here too, Jack. Right here in this building, by a bunch of GS-9s and 10s who go home to their families every night. But the battle is being lost, Jack told himself. It sure as hell isn't being won.
How's the FBI doing? He asked.
Nothing new. The black guy.
Well, he might as well not exist, so far as anyone can tell. They have a crummy picture that's several years old, an alias with no real name or prints to check, and about 10 lines of description that mainly says he's smart enough to keep his mouth shut. The Bureau's checking through people who used to be in the radical groups. Funny how they have mostly settled down. Without any success so far.
How about the bunch who flew over there 2 years back?
Not so long ago, members of several radical American groups had flown to Libya to meet with progressive elements of the Third World community. The echoes of that event still reverberated through the anti-terrorism community.
You've noticed that we don't have any pictures from Benghazi, right? Our agent got picked up. One of those horrible accidents. It cost us the photos, and it cost him his neck. Fortunately, they never found out he was working for us. We know some of the names of the people who were there, but not all.
Passport records?
Cantor leaned against the doorframe.
Let's say Mr. X flew to Europe, an American on vacation. We're talking tens of thousands of people per month. He makes contact with someone on the other side, and they get him the rest of the way, without going through the usual immigration control procedures. It's easy. Hell, the agency does it all the time. If we had a name, we could see if he was out of the country at the right time. That would be a start. But we don't have a name to check.
We don't have anything, Ryan snapped.
Sure we do. We have all that. He waved at the documents on Ryan's desk. And lots more where that came from. Somewhere in there is the answer.
You really believe that?
Every time we crack one of these things, we find that all the information was under our nose for months. The oversight committees in Congress always hammer us on that. Sitting in that pile right now, Jack, is a crucial lead. That's almost a statistical certainty. But you probably have 200 or 300 such reports sitting there, and only one matters. I didn't expect miracles, but I did expect to make some progress, Jack said quietly, the magnitude of the problem finally sinking in. You did. You saw something that no one else did. You may have found Francoise Theroux. And now, if a French agent sees something that might be useful to us, maybe they'll pass it along. You didn't know this, but the intel business is like the old barter economy. We give them, and then they give us, or we'll never give to them again. If this pans out, they'll owe us big time. They really want that gal. She popped a close friend of their president, and he took it personally. Anyway, you get a well done from the Admiral and the DGSE. The boss says you should take it a little easier, by the way. I'll take it easy when I find the bastards, Ryan replied. Sometimes you have to back off. You look like hell. You're tired. Fatigue makes for errors. We don't like errors. No more late hours, Jack. That comes from Greer, too. You're out of here by 6. Cantor left, denying Jack a chance to object. Ryan turned back toward his desk, but stared at the wall for several minutes. Cantor was right. He was working so late that half the time he couldn't drive up to Baltimore to see how his daughter was doing. Jack rationalized that his wife was with her every day, frequently spending the night at Hopkins to be close to their daughter. Kathy has her job, and I have mine. So, he told the wall, at least I managed to get something right. He remembered that it had been an accident, that Marty had made the real connection. But it was also true that he'd done what an analyst was supposed to do, find something odd and bring it to someone's attention. He could feel good about that. He'd found a terrorist, maybe, but certainly not the right one. It's a start. His conscience wondered what the French would do if they found that pretty girl, and how he'd feel about it if he found out. It would be better, he decided, if terrorists were ugly. But pretty or not, their victims were just as dead. He promised himself that he wouldn't go out of his way to find out if anyone got her. Jack went back into the pile, looking for that one piece of hard information. The people he was looking for were somewhere in the pile. He had to find them. Hello, Alex, Miller said as he entered the car. How was the trip? He still had his beard, Dobbins saw. Well, nobody had gotten much of a look at him. This time he'd flown to Mexico, driven across the border, then taken a domestic flight into D.C., where Alex had met him. Your border security over here is a bloody joke. Would it make you happy if they changed it? Alex inquired. Let's talk business. The abruptness of his tone surprised Miller. Aren't you a proud one? With one whole operation under your belt, Miller thought. We have another job for you. You haven't paid me for the last one yet, boy. Miller handed over a passbook. Numbered account, Bahamian Bank. I believe you'll find the amount correct. Alex pocketed the book. That's more like it. Okay. We have another job. I hope you don't expect to go with it as fast as before. We have several months to plan it, Miller replied. I'm listening. Alex sat through 10 minutes of information. Are you out of your fucking mind? Dobbins asked when he was finished. How hard would it be to gather the information we need? That's not the problem, Sean. The problem is getting your people in and out. No way I could handle that.
That is my concern.
Bullshit. If my people are involved, it's my concern, too. If that Clark turkey broke to the cops, it would have burned a safe house. And me. But he didn't break, did he? That's why we chose him. Look, what you do with your people, I don't give a rat's ass. What happens to my people, I do. That last little game we played for you was Bush League, Sean.
Miller figured out what Bush League meant from context.
The operation was politically sound, and you know it. Perhaps you've forgotten that the objective is always political. Politically, the operation was a complete success.
I don't need you to tell me that, Alex snapped back in his best intimidating tone. Miller was a proud little twerp, but Alex figured he could pinch his head off with one good squeeze.
You lost a troop because you were playing this personal, not professional. And I know what you're thinking. It was our first big play, right?
Well, son, I think we proved that we got our shit together, didn't we? And I warned you up front that your man was too exposed. If you'd listened to me, you wouldn't have a man on the inside.
I know your background is pretty impressive, but this is my turf, and I know it.
Miller knew that he had to accept that. He kept his face impassive.
Alex, if we were in any way displeased, we would not have come back to you.
Yes, you do have your shit together.
You bloody nigger, he didn't say. Now, can you get us the information we need?
Sure. For the right price.
You want us in the op?
We don't know yet, Miller replied honestly.
Of course the only issue here is money. Bloody Americans.
If you want us in, I'm part of the planning. Number one, I want to know how you get in and out. I might have to go with you. If you shit can my advice this time, I walk and I take my people with me.
It's a little early to be certain, but what we hope to arrange is really quite simple.
You think you can set that up?
For the first time since he'd arrived, Sean had Alex nodding approval.
Slick. I'll give you that. It's slick.
Now let's talk price.
Sean wrote a figure on a piece of paper and handed it to Alex.
Fair enough.
People interested in money were easy to impress.
I sure would like an account at your bank, brother.
If this operation comes off,
you will.
You mean that?
Miller nodded emphatically.
Direct access. Training facilities. Help with travel documents. The lot. Your skill in helping us last time attracted attention. Our friends liked the idea of an active revolutionary cell in America.
If they really want to do business with you, it's their problem.
Now, how quickly can you get the information?
End of the week, good enough.
Can you do it that fast without attracting attention?
Let me worry about that, Alex replied with a smile.
Anything new on your end? Owens asked.
Not much, Murray admitted. We have plenty of forensic evidence, but only one witness who got a clear look at one face, and she can't give us a real ID.
The local help?
That's who we almost ID'd. Nothing yet. Maybe they've learned from the ULA. No manifesto, no announcement claiming credit for the job. The people we have inside some other radical groups, that is, those that still exist, have drawn a big blank. We're still working on it, and we have a lot of money out on the street, but so far we haven't got anything to show for it.
Murray paused.
That'll change. Bill Shaw is a genius, one of the real brains we have in the Bureau. They switched him over from counterintelligence to terrorism a few years back, and he's done really impressive work.
What's new on your end?
I can't go into specifics yet, Owen said, but we might have a small break. We're trying to decide now if it's real or not. That's the good news. The bad is that His Royal Highness is traveling to America this coming summer. A number of people were informed of his itinerary, including six on our list of possible suspects.
How the hell did you let that happen, Jimmy?
No one asked me, Dan, Owens replied sourly.
In several cases,
If the people hadn't been informed, it would have told them that something odd was happening. You can't simply stop trusting people, can you? For the rest, it was just another balls-up. Some secretary put out the plans on the normal list without consulting the security officers. This wasn't a new story for either man. There was always someone who didn't get the word.
Super.
So call it off. Let him get the flu or something when the time comes, Murray suggested. His Highness won't do that. He's become quite adamant on the subject. He won't allow a terrorist threat to affect his life in any way. Murray grunted.
You gotta admire the kid's guts, but...
Quite so, Owens agreed. He didn't really care for having his next king referred to as the kid, but he'd long since gotten used to the American way of expressing things. It doesn't make our job any easier.
How firm are the travel plans? Murray asked, getting back to business.
Several items on the itinerary are tentative, of course, but most are set in stone. Our security people will be meeting with yours in Washington. They're flying over next week.
Well, you know that you'll get all the cooperation you want. Secret Service, the Bureau, local police, everything.
We'll take good care of him for you, Murray assured him. He and his wife are pretty popular back home.
Will they be taking the baby with them?
No. We were able to prevail on him about that.
Okay.
I'll call Washington tomorrow and get things rolling. What's happening with our friend Ned Clark?
Nothing as yet.
His colleagues are evidently giving him rather a bad time. But he's too bloody stupid to break.
Murray nodded. He knew the type.
Well, they wanted me to take off early, Ryan thought. He decided to accept an invitation to a lecture at Georgetown University. Unfortunately, it was something of a disappointment. Professor David Hunter was Columbia's enfant terrible, America's ranking authority on political affairs in Eastern Europe. His book of the previous year, Revolution Postponed, had been a penetrating study of the political and economic problems of the Soviet's unsteady empire, and Ryan, like others, had been eager to hear his new information on the subject. The speech had turned out to be little more than a rehash of the book, with the rather startling suggestion at the end that the NATO countries should be more aggressive in trying to separate the Soviet Union from her captives. Ryan considered that to be lunacy, even if it did guarantee lively discussions at the reception. At the end of the talk, Ryan moved quickly to the reception. He'd skipped dinner to make it here on time. There was a wide table of hors d'oeuvres, and Jack filled his plate as patiently as he could before drifting off to a sedate corner by the elevators. He let others form knots of conversation around Professor Hunter. On the whole, it was nice to be back at Georgetown, if only for a few hours. The Galleria in the Intercultural Center was quite a contrast to the CIA institutional drab. The four-story atrium of the language building was lined with the glass windows of offices, and a pair of potted trees reached toward the glass roof. The plaza outside was paved with bricks, and known to the students as Red Square. To the west was the old quadrangle and the cemetery where rested the priests who had taught here for nearly 200 years. It was a thoroughly civilized setting, except for the discordant shriek of jets coming out of National Airport a few miles downriver. Someone jostled Ryan just as he was finishing his snacks.
"Excuse me, doctor."
Ryan turned to see a man shorter than himself. He had a florid complexion and was dressed in a cheap-looking suit. His blue eyes seemed to sparkle with amusement. His voice had a pronounced accent.
"Did you enjoy the lecture?"
"It was interesting," Ryan said diffidently.
"So, I see that capitalists can lie as well as we poor socialists."
The man had a jolly, overpowering laugh, but Jack decided that his eyes were sparkling with something other than amusement. They were measuring eyes, playing yet another variation of the game he'd been part of in England. Already, Ryan disliked him.
"Have we met?"
"Sergei Platonov."
They shook hands after Ryan set his plate on a table.
"I am third secretary of the Soviet embassy. Perhaps my photograph at Langley does not do me justice."
A Russian.
Ryan tried not to look too surprised. Who knows, I've been working at CIA. Third secretary could easily mean that he was KGB, perhaps a diplomatic intelligence specialist, or maybe a member of the CPSU's foreign department. As though it made a difference. A legal intelligence officer with a diplomatic cover. What do I do now? For one thing, he knew that he'd have to write up a contact report for CIA tomorrow, explaining how they'd met and what they'd talked about. Perhaps an hour's work. It took an effort to remain polite. You must have the wrong guy, Mr. Platinoff. I'm a history teacher. I work at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. I was invited to this because I got my degree here.
No, no.
The Russian shook his head.
I recognize you from the photograph on your book jacket. You see, I purchased 10 copies of it last summer.
Indeed. Jack was surprised again and unable to conceal it. My publisher and I thank you, sir.
Our naval attaché was much taken by it, Dr. Ryan. He felt that it should be brought to the attention of the Frunz Academy, and, I think, the Gretschko Naval Academy in Leningrad.
Platinoff applied his considerable charm. Ryan knew it for what it was, but...
To be honest, I merely skimmed the book myself. It seemed quite well organized, and the attaché said that your analysis of the way decisions are made in the heat of battle was highly accurate.
Well, Jack tried not to be overly flattered, but it was hard. Frunze was the Soviet Staff Academy, the finishing school for young field-grade officers who were tagged for stardom. The Gretschko Academy was only slightly less prestigious.
"Sergei Nikolaevich," boomed a familiar voice. "It is not kulturny to prey upon the vanity of helpless young authors."
Father Timothy Riley joined them. A short, plump Jesuit priest, Riley had headed the history department at Georgetown while Ryan had gotten his doctorate. He was a brilliant intellect with a series of books to his credit, including 2 penetrating works on the history of Marxism. Neither of which, Ryan was certain, had found their way into the library at Frunze.
"How's the family, Jack?"
"Kathy's back to work, Father. They moved Sally over to Hopkins. With luck, we'll have her home early next week."
"She will recover fully, your little daughter?" Platinoff asked. "I read about the attack on your family in the newspaper."
"We think so. Except for losing her spleen, there seems to be no permanent damage. The docs say she's recovering nicely. And with her at Hopkins, Kathy's able to see her every day," Ryan said, more positively than he felt. Sally was a different child. Her legs weren't fully healed yet, but worst of all, his bouncing little girl was a sad thing now. She'd learned a lesson that Ryan had hoped to hold off for at least 10 more years— that the world is a dangerous place, even when you have a mother and a father to take care of you. A hard lesson for a child. It was harder still for a parent. "But she's alive," Jack told himself, unaware of the expression on his face. "With time and love, you can recover from anything, except death." The doctors and nurses at Hopkins were taking care of her like one of their own. That was a tangible advantage of having a doctor in the family.
"A terrible thing."
Platinoff shook his head in what seemed to be genuine disgust.
"A terrible thing to attack innocent people for no reason."
"Indeed, Sergei," Riley said in the astringent voice that Ryan had known so well. When he wanted, Father Tim had a tongue that could saw through wood. "I seem to recall that V.I. Lenin said the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize, and that sympathy in a revolutionary is as reprehensible as cowardice on the field of battle."
"Those were hard times, good father," Platinoff said smoothly. "My country has no business with those IRA madmen. They are not revolutionaries, however much they pretend to be. They have no revolutionary ethic. It is madness what they do. The working classes should be allies, contesting together against the common enemy that exploits them both, instead of killing one another. Both sides of the conflict are victimized by bosses who play them off against each other, but instead of recognizing this, they kill one another like mad dogs, and with as little point. They are bandits, not revolutionaries, he concluded, with a distinction lost on the other two. Maybe so. But if I ever get my hands on them, I'll give them a lesson in revolutionary justice. It was good to let his hatred out in the open for once. You have no sympathy for them, either of you, Platonov baited them. After all, you are both related to the victims of British imperialism. Did not both your families flee to America to escape it? Ryan was caught very short by that remark. It seemed an incredible thing to say until he saw that the Russian was watching for his reaction. Or perhaps the direct victim of Soviet imperialism, Jack responded with his own look. Those two guys in London had Kalashnikov rifles. So did the ones who attacked my wife, he lied. You don't buy one of those at the local hardware store. Whether you choose to admit it or not, most of the terrorists over there profess to be Marxists. That makes them your allies, not mine, and it makes it appear more than a coincidence that they use Soviet arms. Do you know how many countries manufacture weapons of Soviet design? It is sadly inevitable that some will fall into the wrong hands. In any case, my sympathy for their aim is, shall we say, limited by their choice of technique. You can't build a civilized country on a foundation of murder, Ryan concluded, much as some people have tried. It would be well if the world worked in more peaceful ways. Platonov ignored the implicit comment on the Soviet Union. But it is an historical fact that nations are born in blood, even yours. As countries grow, they mature beyond such conduct. It is not easy, but I think we can all see the value of peaceful coexistence. For myself, Dr. Ryan, I can sympathize with your feelings. I have two fine sons. We once had a daughter also, Nadia. She died long time ago, at age 7, from leukemia. I know it is a hard thing to see your child in pain. But you are more fortunate than I. Your daughter will live. He allowed his voice to soften. We disagree on many things, but no man can fail to love his children. So, Platonov changed gears smoothly. What did you really think of Professor Hunter's little speech? Should America seek to foment counter-revolution in the socialist states of Europe? Why don't you ask the State Department? That's not my part of the world, remember? I teach naval history. But if you want a personal opinion, I don't see how we can encourage people to rebel if we have no prospect of helping them directly when your country reacts. Ah, good. You understand that we must act to protect our fraternal socialist brothers from aggression. The man was good, Ryan saw. But he'd had a lot of practice at this. I wouldn't call the encouragement of people to seek their own freedom a form of aggression, Mr. Platonov. I was a stockbroker before I got my history degree, and that doesn't make me much of a candidate for sympathizing with your political outlook. What I am saying is that your country used military force to crush democratic feelings in Czechoslovakia and Hungary. To encourage people toward their own suicide is both immoral and counterproductive. Ah, but what does your government think? The Russian asked with another jolly laugh. I'm a historian, not a soothsayer. In this town, they all work for the post. Ask them. In any case, the Russian went on, our naval attaché is most interested to meet you and discuss your book. We are having a reception at the embassy on the 12th of next month. The good father is coming. He can watch over your soul. Might you and your wife attend? For the next few weeks, I plan to be at home with my family. My girl needs me there for a while.
the diplomat was not to be put off.
Yes, I can understand that. Some other time, perhaps.
Sure. Give me a call sometime this summer.
Are you kidding?
Excellent. Now, if you will excuse me, I wish to speak to Professor Hunter.
The diplomat shook hands again and walked off to the knot of Russians who were hanging on Hunter's every word. Ryan turned to Father Riley, who'd watched the exchange in silence while sipping at his champagne.
Interesting guy, Sergei, Riley said. He loves to hit people for reactions. I wonder if he really believes in his system or if he's just playing the game for points.
Ryan had a more immediate question. Father, what in the hell was that all about? Riley chuckled.
You're being checked out, Jack.
Why?
You don't need me to answer that. You're working at CIA. If I guess right, Admiral Greer wants you on his personal staff. Marty Cantor is taking a job at the University of Texas next year, and you're one of the candidates for his job. I don't know if Sergei is aware of that, but you probably looked like the best target of opportunity in the room, and he wanted to get a feel for you. Happens all the time.
Cantor's job? But nobody told me that.
The world's full of surprises. They probably haven't finished the full background check on you yet, and they won't pop the offer until they do. I presume the information you're looking at is still pretty limited.
I can't discuss that, Father. The priest smiled. Thought so. The work you've done over there has impressed the right people. If I have things right, they're going to bring you along like a good welterweight prospect.
Riley got another glass of champagne. If I know James Greer, he'll just sort of ease you into it.
What did it, you see, was that canary trap thing. It really impressed some folks.
How do you know all this?
Ryan asked, shocked at what he'd just heard.
Jack,
how do you think you got over there in the first place? Who do you think got you that Center for Strategic and International Studies fellowship? The people there liked your work, too. Between what I said and what they said, Marty thought you were worth a look last summer, and you worked up better than anyone expected. There are some people around town who respect my opinion.
Oh. Ryan had to smile. He'd allowed himself to forget the first thing about the Society of Jesus. They know everyone, from whom they can learn nearly everything. The president of the university belonged to both the Cosmos and University clubs, with which came access to the most important ears and mouths in Washington. That's how it would start. Occasionally a man would need advice on something, and being unable to consult the people he worked with, he might try to discuss it with a clergyman. No one was better qualified for this than a Jesuit, meticulously educated, well-versed in the ways of the world, but not spoiled by it. Most of the time. Like any clergyman, each was a good listener. So effective was the society at gathering information that the State Department's codebreakers had once been tasked to break the Jesuits' own cipher systems. The assignment had started a small revolt in the Black Chamber, until they'd realized what sort of information was finding its way to them. When St. Ignatius Loyola had founded the order, the ex-soldier set it on a path to do only two things, to send out missionaries and to build schools. Both had been done extraordinarily well. The influence passed on by the schooling would never be lost on the men who'd graduated. It wasn't Machiavellian, not really. The colleges and universities plied its students with philosophy and ethics and theology, all required courses, to mute their baser tendencies and sharpen their wits. For centuries the Jesuits had built men for others, and wielded a kind of invisible temporal power, mainly for the good. Father Riley's intellectual credentials were widely known, and his opinions would be sought, just as from any distinguished academic, added to which was his moral authority as a graduate theologian. "We're good security risks, Jack," Riley said benignly.
Can you imagine one of us being a communist agent? So, are you interested in the job?
I don't know.
Ryan looked at his reflection in a window. It would mean more time away from the family. We're expecting another one this summer, you know.
Congratulations. That's good news.
I know you're a family man, Jack. The job would mean some sacrifices. But you're a good man for it.
Think so?
I haven't exactly set the world on fire yet. I'd rather see people like you over there than some others I know. Jack, you're plenty smart enough. You know how to make decisions, but more importantly, you're a pretty good fellow. I know you're ambitious, but you've got ethics, values. I'm one of those people who thinks that still matters for something in the world, regardless of how nasty things get.
They get pretty nasty, Father, Ryan said after a moment.
How close are you to finding them?
Not very close.
Jack stopped himself too late.
You did that one pretty well.
I didn't mean it that way, Father Tim said very sincerely. It would be a better world if they were off the street. There must be something wrong with the way they think. It's hard to understand how anyone could deliberately hurt a child.
Father, you really don't have to understand them. You just have to know where to find them.
That's work for the police, and the courts, and a jury.
That's why we have laws, Jack, Riley said gently.
Ryan turned to the window again. He examined his own image and wondered what it was that he saw.
Father, you're a good man, but you've never had kids of your own.
I can forgive somebody who comes after me, maybe, but not anyone who tries to hurt my little girl. If I find him, hell, I won't. But I sure would like to,
Jack told the image of himself.
Yes, it agreed.
It's not a good thing, hate. It might do things to you that you'll regret, things that can change you from the person you are.
Ryan turned back, thinking about the person he'd just looked at.
Maybe it already has.
Chapter 20. Data.
It was a singularly boring tape. Owens was used to reading police reports, transcripts of interrogations, and, worst of all, intelligence documents. But the tape was even more boring than that. The microphone which the security service had hidden in Cooley's shop was sound-activated and sensitive enough to pick up any noise. The fact that Cooley hummed a lot made Owens regret this feature. The detective whose job it was to listen to the unedited tape had included several minutes of the awful atonal noise to let his commander know what he had to suffer through. The bell finally rang. Owens heard the clatter, made metallic by the recording system, of the door opening and closing, then the sound of Cooley's swivel chair scraping across the floor.
It must have had a bad wheel, Owens noted.
Good morning, sir.
It was Cooley's voice.
And to you, said the second.
Well, have you finished the Marlowe?
Yes, I have.
So what's the price?
Cooley didn't say it aloud, but Ashley had told Owens that the shop owner never spoke a price. He handed it to his customers on a file card. That, Owens thought, was one way to keep from haggling.
That is quite steep, you know. Watkins' voice observed.
I could get more, but you are one of our better clients, Cooley replied.
The sigh was audible on the tape.
Very well. It is worth it.
The transaction was made at once. They could hear the rasping sound of new banknotes being counted.
I may soon have something new from a collection in Kerry, Cooley said next.
Oh, there was interest in the reply.
Yes, a signed first edition of Great Expectations. I saw it on my last trip over. Might you be interested in that?
Signed, eh?
Yes, sir. Boz himself. I realize that the Victorian period is rather more recent than most of your acquisitions, but the author's signature...
Indeed.
I would like to see it, of course. That can be arranged.
At this point, Owens told Ashley, Watkins leaned over and our man in the jewelry shop lost sight of him.
So he could have passed a message.
Possibly. Owens switched off the tape machine. The rest of the conversation had no significance.
The last time he was in Ireland, Cooley didn't go to County Kerry. He was in Cork the whole time. He visited 3 dealers in rare books, spent the night in a hotel, and had a few pints at a local pub, Ashley reported.
A pub?
Yes. He drinks in Ireland, but not in London.
Did he meet anyone there?
Impossible to tell. Our man wasn't close enough. His orders were to be discreet, and he did well not to be spotted.
Ashley was quiet for a moment as he tried to pin down something on the tape.
It sounded to me as though he paid cash for the book.
He did, and it is out of pattern. Like most of us, he uses checks and credit cards for the majority of his transactions, but not for this. His bank records show no checks to this shop, though he does occasionally make large cash withdrawals. They may or may not match with his purchases there.
How very odd, Ashley thought aloud. Everyone...
Well, someone must know that he goes there.
Checks have dates on them, Owens suggested.
Perhaps. Ashley wasn't convinced, but he'd done enough investigations of this kind to know that you never got all the answers. Some details were always left hanging.
I took another look at Jeff's service record last night.
Do you know that when he was in Ireland, he had 4 men killed in his platoon?
What?
That makes him a fine candidate for our investigation.
Owens didn't think this was good news.
That's what I thought, Ashley agreed.
I had one of our chaps in Germany, his former regiment's assigned to the BAOR at the moment, interview one of Watkins's mates. Had a platoon in the same company. The chap's a half-colonel now. He said that Jeff took it quite hard, that he was quite vociferous on the point that they were in the wrong place, doing the wrong thing, and losing people in the process. Rather puts a different spin on things, doesn't it?
Another lieutenant with a solution to the problem,
Owen snorted.
Yes, we leave and let the bloody Irish sort things out. That's not exactly a rare sentiment in the army, you know.
It wasn't exactly a rare sentiment throughout England, Commander Owens knew.
Even so, it's not much of a basis for motive, is it?
Better than nothing at all.
The carp grunted agreement.
What else did the colonel tell your chap?
Obviously, Jeff had a rather busy tour of duty in the Belfast area. He and his men saw a lot. They were there when the army was welcomed in by the Catholics, and they were there when the situation reversed.
It was a bad time for everyone, Ashley added unnecessarily.
It's still not very much. We have a former subaltern, now in the Striped Pants Brigade, who didn't like being in Northern Ireland. He happens to buy rare books from a chap who grew up there and now runs a completely legitimate business in central London. You know what any solicitor would say? Pure coincidence. We don't have one single thing that can remotely be called evidence. The background of each man is pure enough to qualify him for sainthood.
These are the people we've been looking for, Ashley insisted.
Oh, I know that.
Owens almost surprised himself when he said it for the first time. His professionalism told him that this was a mistake, but his instincts told him otherwise.
It wasn't a new feeling for the commander of C-13, but one that always made him uneasy. If his instincts were wrong, he was looking in the wrong place, at the wrong people. But his instincts were almost never wrong.
You know the rules of the game, and by those rules I don't even have enough to go to the commissioner. He'd boot me out of the office, and be right to do so. We have nothing but unsupported suspicions.
The two men stared at each other for several seconds.
I never wanted to be a policeman.
Ashley smiled and shook his head.
I didn't get my wish either.
I wanted to be an engine driver when I was 6. But my father said there were enough railway people in the family. So I became a copper.
Both men laughed. There wasn't anything else to do.
I'll increase the surveillance on Cooley's trips abroad. I don't think there's much more to be done on your side,
Ashley said finally. We have to wait for them to make a mistake. Sooner or later they all do, you know.
But soon enough?
That was the question.
Here we are, Alex said. How did you get these? Miller asked in amazement. Routine, man. Power companies shoot aerial photographs of their territory all the time. They help us plan the surveys we have to do. And here,
he reached into his briefcase, is a topographic map.
There's your target, boy.
Alex handed him a magnifying glass borrowed from his company. It was a color shot, taken on a bright sunny day. You could tell the makes of the cars. It must have been done the previous summer. The grass had just been cut.
How tall is the cliff?
Enough that you don't want to fall off it.
Tricky, too. I forget what it's made of, sandstone or something crumbly, but you want to be careful with it. See that fence here? The man knows to keep away from the edge. We had the same problem at our reactor plant at Calvert Cliff. It's the same geological structure, and a lot of work went into giving the plant a solid foundation.
Only one road in, Miller noted.
Dead end, too. That is a problem. We have these gullies here and here. Notice that the power line comes in cross-country from this road over here. It looks like there was an old farm road that connected with this one, but they let it go to seed. That's going to be helpful.
How? No one can use it.
I'll tell you later. Friday, you and me are going fishing.
What?
Miller looked up in surprise.
You want to eyeball the cliff, right? Besides, the blues are running. I love bluefish.
Breckenridge had silhouette targets up finally. Jack's trips to the range were less frequent now, mainly in the mornings before class. If nothing else, the incident outside the gate had told the Marine and civilian guards that their jobs were valuable. 2 Marines and 1 of the civilians were also firing their service pieces. They didn't just shoot to qualify now. They were all shooting for scores. Jack hit the button to reel his target in. His rounds were all clustered in the center of the target.
Pretty good, Doc. The sergeant major was standing behind him. If you want, we can run a competition string. I figure you'll qualify for a medal now.
Ryan shook his head. He still had to shower after his morning jog. I'm not doing this for score, Gunny.
When does the little girl come home?
Next Wednesday, I hope.
That's good, sir. Who's going to look after her?
Kathy's taking a few weeks off.
My wife asked if y'all might need any help, Breckenridge said.
Jack turned in surprise. Sissy, Commander Jackson's wife, will be over most of the time.
Please thank your wife for us, Gunny. That's damn nice of her.
No big deal.
Any luck finding the bastards?
Ryan's day hops to CIA were not much of a secret.
Not yet. Good morning, Alex, the field superintendent said. You're staying in a little late. What can I do for you?
Bert Griffin was always in early, but he rarely saw Dobbins before he went home at 7 every morning.
I've been looking over the specifications on that new Westinghouse transformer.
Getting dull working nights? Griffin asked with a smile. This was a fairly easy time of year for the utility company. In the summer, with all the air conditioners up and running, things would be different, of course. Spring was the time of year for new ideas.
I think we're ready to give it a try.
Have they ironed the bugs out?
Pretty much. Enough for a field test, I think.
Okay. Griffin sat back in his chair. Tell me about it.
Mainly, sir, I'm worried about the old ones. The problem's only going to get worse as we start retiring the old units. We had that chemical spill last month.
Oh, yeah.
Griffin rolled his eyes. Most of the units in use contained PBBs, polybrominated biphenyls, as a cooling element within the power transformer. These were dangerous to the linemen, who were supposed to wear protective clothing when working on them, but, despite company rules, often didn't bother. PBBs were a serious health hazard to the men. Even worse, the company had to dispose of the toxic liquid periodically. It was expensive and ran the risk of spills, the paperwork for which was rapidly becoming as time-consuming as that associated with the company's nuclear reactor plant. Westinghouse was experimenting with a transformer that used a completely inert chemical in place of the PBBs. Though expensive, it held great promise for long-term economies, and would help get the environmentalists off their backs, which was even more attractive than the monetary savings. Alex, if you can get those babies up and working, I will personally get you a new company car.
Well, I want to try one out. Westinghouse will lend us one for free.
This is really starting to sound good, Griffin noted. But have they really ironed the bugs out yet?
They say so, except for some occasional voltage fluctuations. They're not sure what causes that, and they want to do some field tests.
How bad are the fluctuations?
Marginal. Alex pulled out a pad and read off the numbers. It seems to be an environmental problem. Looks like it only happens when the ambient air temperature changes rapidly. If that's the real cause, it shouldn't be too hard to beat.
Griffin considered that for a few seconds.
Okay. Where do you want to set it up? I have a spot picked out down in Anne Arundel County, south of Annapolis.
That's a long ways away. Why there?
It's a dead-end line. If the transformer goes bad, it won't hurt many houses. The other thing is, one of my crews is only 20 miles away, and I've been training them on the new unit. We'll set up the test instrumentation, and I can have them check it every day for the first few months. If it works out, we can make our purchase order in the fall and start setting them up next spring.
Okay. Where exactly is this?
Dobbins unfolded his map on Griffin's table.
Right here.
Expensive neighborhood, the field superintendent said dubiously.
Oh, come on, boss, Alex snorted. How would it look in the papers if we did all our experiments on poor folk?
Besides, he smiled, all those environmental freaks are rich, aren't they?
Dobbins had chosen his remark with care. One of Griffin's personal hobby horses was the Park Avenue environmentalist. The field superintendent owned a small farm and didn't like having some condo-owning dilettante tell him about nature.
Okay, you can run with it. How soon can you set it up?
Westinghouse can have the unit to us the end of next week. I can have it up and running 3 days after that. I want my crew to check the lines. In fact, I'll be going down myself to set it up, if you don't mind.
Griffin nodded approval.
You're my kind of engineer, son. Most of the schoolboys we get now are afraid to get their hands dirty. You'll keep me posted?
Yes, sir.
Keep up the good work, Alex. I've been telling management about you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Griffin.
Dobbins left the building and drove home in his 2-year-old company Plymouth. Most of the rush hour traffic was heading in while he headed out. He was home in under an hour. Sean Miller was just waking up, drinking tea and watching television. Alex wondered how anyone could start the day with tea. He made some instant coffee for himself.
Well? Miller asked.
No problem.
Alex smiled, then stopped. It occurred to him that he'd miss his job. After all the talk in college about bringing power to the people, he'd realized with surprise after starting with BG&E that a utility company engineer did exactly that. In a funny sort of way, he was now serving the ordinary people.
though not in a manner that carried much significance. Dobbins decided that it was good training for his future ambitions. He'd remember that even those who served humbly still served. An important lesson for the future. Come on. We'll talk about it in the boat. Wednesday was a special day. Jack was away from both his jobs, carrying the bear while Kathy wheeled their daughter out. The bear was a gift from the midshipman of his history classes, an enormous monster that weighed 60 pounds and was nearly 5 feet tall, topped off with a smoky bear hat. Actually, that of a marine drill instructor, courtesy of Breckenridge and the guard detail. A police officer opened the door for the procession. It was a windy March day, but the family wagon was parked just outside. Jack scooped up his daughter in both arms while Kathy thanked the nurses. He made sure she was in her safety seat and buckled the belt himself. The bear had to go in the back. "Ready to go home, Sally?" "Yes." Her voice was listless. The nurses reported that she still cried out in her sleep. Her legs were fully healed, finally. She could walk again, badly and awkwardly, but she could walk. Except for the loss of her spleen, she was whole again. Her hair was trimmed short to compensate for what had been shaved, but that would grow out soon enough. Even the scars, the surgeon said, would fade, and the pediatricians assured him that in a few months the nightmares would end. Jack turned to run his hand along the little face and got a smile for his efforts. It wasn't the smile he was accustomed to getting. Behind his own smile, Ryan's mind boiled with rage yet again, but he told himself that this wasn't the time. Sally needed a father now, not an avenger. "We have a surprise waiting for you," he said. "What?" Sally asked. "If I told you, it wouldn't be a surprise," her father pointed out. "Daddy!" For a moment, his little girl was back. "Wait and see." "What's that?" Kathy asked on getting in the car. "The surprise." "What surprise?" "See," Jack told his daughter. "Mommy doesn't know either."
"Jack, what's going on?"
"Dr. Schenck and I had a little talk last week," was all Ryan would say. He released the parking brake and headed off onto Broadway.
"I want my bear,"
Sally said.
"He's too big to sit there, honey,"
Kathy responded. "But you can wear his smoky hat. He said it was okay." Jack handed it back. The wide-brimmed campaign hat dropped over her head.
"Did you thank the people for the bear?" Kathy asked.
"You bet." Ryan smiled for a moment. "Nobody flunks this term. But don't tell anybody that." Jack had a reputation as a tough marker. That might not survive this semester. Principals be damned, he told himself. The mids in his classes had sent Sally a steady stream of flowers, toys, puzzles, and cards that had entertained his little girl, then circulated around the pediatric floor and brightened the days of 50 more sick kids. Smoky Bear was the crowning achievement. The nurses had told Kathy that it had made a difference. The monster toy had often sat at the top of Sally's bed, with the little girl clinging to it. It would be a tough act to follow, but Jack had that one figured out. Skip Tyler was making the final arrangements now. Jack took his time, driving as though he were carrying a cargo of cracked eggs. His recent habits at CIA made him yearn for a cigarette, but he knew that he'd have to stop that now, with Kathy home all the time. He was careful to avoid the route Kathy had taken the day that... His hands tightened on the wheel, as they had for weeks now. He knew he had to stop thinking about it so much. It had become an obsession, and that wasn't going to help anything. The scenery had changed since the... accident. What had been bare trees now had the green edges of buds and leaves with the beginning of spring. Horses and cows were out on the farms. Some calves and colts were visible, and Sally's nose pressed against the car window as she looked at them. As it did every year, life was renewing itself, Ryan told himself. His family was whole again, and he'd keep it that way. The last turn onto Falcon's Nest Road finally came. Jack noted that the utility trucks were still around, and he wondered briefly what they had been up to as he turned left into his driveway. "Skip's here?" Kathy asked.